Okay. They all hear me. So, thank you for staying. That's the last talk of the day, maybe. You want to go for dinner. So, I prepare a talk a bit different from the others. So, I have some presentations ready for, you know, global geodynamics, some interesting work on fractal plate tectonics. I invite you to look at it, that published 3 years ago in APSL. Just look at 2013. But I decided to present something else today. I wrote to Bruce and to Carolina that because this is a summer school, I want to present you something more technical, something about, you know, Python, Jupyter, notebooks. Because, you know, most of the people here, you're young, and you will do science for the next year where technology will be more important. And I want to present something a bit more provocative about a bit about education, just very shortly, and about science communication. So I will show some numerical results at the end. So the second part of the talk is my collaborators, Dave Yu and Peter Mora from Australia. Okay. So the goal. So basically, the idea to work on education in geoscience came basically 2 years ago when I had to go for personal visa for 1 year leave. So I was like at home for a year. So I decided to. I couldn't do modeling. I was far away. So I decided to write a book. And it was about a book about geodynamic modeling. And there are a lot of books around about geodynamic modeling, about mantle convection, about solid mechanics. So I decided to write a bit in a different style. And the book that was, I really understood that really should not be bored by reading the book. I should have fun, okay? So maybe not that fun, that's not great. But you know, something closer to that, something you really enjoy to do, enjoy to, you know, to read, and you know, that you have fun. So of course, no, we all know why children have fun, because they have a very interactive way to learn. So they don't learn by reading, by listening. You can explain things to children will not listen to you. They just learn because they do stuff, and by experiences they learn. And so the idea is that students should learn in the same way. Of course, it's not easy, because you know, we are doing things that are quite complicated. They require a lot of technology. It's not easy to learn by yourself. You need to develop tools that are quite sophisticated. And you have seen some tutorials that have been developed in this school. You know, it took a lot of work to the people who did it here. It's not easy to do that. So I wrote this book about with the same philosophy. So to like, it's like every chapter is like a tutorial in itself. And so the idea is to teach step by step how to introduce geodynamics. So first of all, I had to choose a language. So before I didn't to write this book, I didn't give much importance about which language I use. Okay, I always say, okay, who cares? I program something in C, I program in Fortran. I didn't even think it was important. Okay, so like you speak Italian, you speak English. I mean, who cares? The important is the message. But actually, by looking at how students learn, how you program, I understood that it's not really like this. I mean, there are really some languages that are really made for learning, okay? There are just some, it's like if there are some languages that are more toward the machines, okay? And some languages that are toward the humans. And so if the language is towards you, so it's close to you, it's close to how you think, it will be easier to play with it, okay? It will be easier to interact with it, it will be more interactive. And actually a lot of modern computing is going into this idea that computation should be more interactive. And certainly, the Jupyter notebook that you've been used and many of the tutorials here went into this direction and accepted this idea in itself, that there to be as much interactive as possible, as much as playful as possible. And the second thing is about time. So typically, when you do a course like in geoscience, but also in physics and others, you tend to learn computing quite late. Okay? Now, things are changing. For example, at MIT, it is really mandatory for all science to learn computer science in the freshman year. You have to. So that's the book that they use at MIT from John Kutak. It's a great book. It's one of the things that they use mostly to build a mind. There are really a lot of ideas. They spend many years to develop a lot of tutorials and interesting approaches to teach to freshmen computing. And what they use Python. Okay? And I found also another many courses in other universities how to start introduce computing to the younger students. They also use Python. It's really like a convergence. People are converging toward one approach, one language. Okay. And another thing that you can see that is that if you look at the professional level, for example, now it's a big thing, it's like machine learning, it's like everywhere. It's like hot, like Google is doing machine learning, everybody's doing machine learning, and also in science. And all tools for machine learning, for example, are in Python. So there is really a convergence into using this language. It's a bit special. So I will show just a few slides to show what is special in it, and then I will show some application in geoscience that are more related to us. Okay, so I was saying, so one motivation for this talk was pedagogy. The other is more provocative. It's about our papers that we write. So this is an article that came out very recently. So it's 5 April 2018, where say the scientific paper is obsolete. So what does that mean? That's a kind of a strong statement. But basically, the message of the, it's a long article, you can read it. It's very interesting that I introduced to many scientists here in the Bay Area. And basically, the main message is that a lot of modern scientific results are based on numerical models that are very complicated. And they need a lot, for example, a lot of data, or they need very large numerical models that you cannot basically write. So in a sense, so if you think of the history of the scientific papers, really in the 19th century and the 20th century, the idea was that you could read the scientific paper, you could understand it carefully, and then you could reproduce the results. There were mathematical calculations, you could take a piece of paper and redo them. Or there were a few data, you could check that the calculations were correct. Or maybe the people who did that calculation have done a certain approach, a certain approximation, a certain assumption. Well, you can do it different ones, and you can check whether the result changed. Okay, this is the deep meaning of writing a scientific paper. That's what you read. But if what is written in the scientific paper is so complicated that it's impossible for you to reproduce it. So you cannot really redo the work. You cannot reproduce it in any way. Well, then you can just believe it, okay? So if you trust the scientist who did it, you say, okay, well, I trust the scientist, it's probably good work. Or maybe not, but I mean, the whole idea of the scientific paper is sort of lost, okay? So it's just a communication. So the idea how to overcome that, and the main idea to overcome that has been proposed now by many scientists, probably it's very naive at the beginning, is to use Jupyter notebooks instead of scientific paper. Now, of course, this is not the solution for every possible scientific result. But many of the works that we do, we don't just write equation and solve this equation, but we really do it numerically, or we do, you know, we process data. Well, what we can do, we can put all this in a notebook, okay? So Jupyter notebooks, as you've seen in this tutorial, they allow you to write, you know, a really paper format. So with titles, sections, equations, everything like in a paper. But on top of that, they allow you to write really the code, really the explicit way in which you have done your work. With all the approximations, all the assumptions that you made, it's all there explicitly out, okay? So that's what, it's like a fusion, okay? So if you write a paper plus you attach some software to show what you did, the Jupyter notebook, it's all of that in one, okay? It's one format. So this is a new idea that is out. I know that there have been also proposed with you to open a journal that will be only used in Jupyter notebooks. So people really will be able to read what you do, and immediately you can change. You have an idea, you want to change some approximation, you want to change a data set, well, you can do it, you know, in an instant. You don't need to redo the whole code that somebody else has done. You have it for you. So it's really a different framework to think about. Okay, that's my book. It's a bit of promotion. And I want to say that all the tutorials that are in the book are also available on GitHub. There are some things that I need to adjust, but you can see, just go GitHub on GabberC, that's sort of my nickname online, and just look for Pythonic Geodynamics, and you will find all the one Python notebook for each chapter of the book. So you can just, you don't need to buy the book, really. You can just find it online. I found a lot of copy and a lot of places in the world where you can download the PDF. It's okay, I don't care. But you can also use a Python notebook, so that's really useful. And if you find little mistake, just write to me. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to spend the summer to fix all the problem and put all the solution of the exercises there. OK, let's talk a little bit about Python. So why people like so much Python? But this has been chosen by so many to do science. Okay. So one thing I saw that we had this nice talk last day about software is that the software, you will read the software much more than you write. Okay. So that's has been, you know, that's the design of Python. It's a very official way to write it. So the readability counts. Okay. Software should be easy to read. You don't want to spend a lot of time to think about all the variables, what they mean. And you know, it should not be there should be too many of a structure that you know you just don't understand what they code. It should be as simple as reading a bunch of equations in a paper. So it should be simple. And if the implementation is very complicated, well, that's probably what this how software engineers like to think is a bad idea. And that's of course it's the art of being a good programmer. That's not easy. Okay. So one of the criticisms that I still receive a lot of time, and people continue to tell, okay, but Python is very slow, okay? So how slow is Python? And actually Python for most, almost all the applications that we do as a pseudonymous, as a geoscientist, is really as almost as fast as C, okay? And it's very simple. The reason is that almost every operation that we do can be vectorized, because you can write almost all every mathematical operation that we do is a PDE. And every PDE can be discretized, it can be vectorized. So if you can vectorize, you know, so if you don't use vectorized, let me see an example. I showed you a very tiny example, you can find many others in the notebooks in the book. So if you write, for example, if you have two different arrays, and you want to sum an array with for loop, this is not a vectorized operation. This will be very slow, okay? Like 650 milliseconds for adding two arrays of 1 million elements. If you use instead vectorized operation, this is 100 times faster or more, okay? So the reason because many people find Python slow, but also it's the same for MATLAB, is that they don't use vectorized operation. Use that to use a lot of loops, things like that. That makes, you know, the code kind of better but slow, like 100 times slower than any compiled code, so it makes it almost useful for doing science. You just have to pay a little bit of attention and vectorize all your operations. This is really, you just need to learn two or three techniques. And I, in my book, I wrote all of them in chapter 3. So just one chapter, you read it, just a few techniques, you vectorize your operation, and your Python code will be almost as fast as C. There is some little gap here and there because you have to pass one array to the next operation, but it's really almost the same. So you don't need really to worry about that. There is cycle, which is means you can write some part and compile them. It's a lot only for advanced programmers. And you can write, so if you want to write code in parallel, it works very well. I will show an example now where, for example, I wrote code with a colleague with Peter Moore, which we parallelize our code to 1,000 processors. And it just works fine. But here are just a few examples that are from the book. For example, this is a well-known method. So this is finite volume method with particles in it. It is used by a lot of people. For example, there is this book of Taras Gerry, for example, where he shows a similar technique. And also, of course, there is Underworld and many other software that use this similar technique. You can program all that very easily in Python. Okay, so just it's really just a few. This may be 40 lines of code, okay, to do all that. And you can implement, of course, Lagrangian advection. You can implement, so this is an example how it looks like, okay? So if you want, for example, in particle itself, you solve your equation on many cells, of what is a volume, this particle, this is finite volume. And then you have all these particles that, you know, just Lagrangian particle that will advect your composition or your temperature, whatever you want. And then what you do, which is very big invention, this method, you have all your information on the particles you want to project it on the mesh, and then from the mesh you solve your PDEs, your partial differential equations, and you project all the information to the particles, and you move your particles. This allows you to do modeling without diffusion, and that's many advantages. Just to give an example, a vectorized code, for example, all these operations to project all the information from the lattice, from the volume, from the corners of this volume to the particles, it's just one line of code. That's the vectorized version of this projection. Okay? And there are several ways to write to put your weights, depending whether you want to use an arithmetic average, geometric average. And yeah, you see the importance of see how things are done. So do not use a code that is just blind to you. If you just have one code, you see exactly how operations are done, so you know which approximation have been used. This is the opposite operation to project information from the particles to the mesh. So these are a few lines, but it's really, you know, the maximum is 10 lines of code, just because it is 2D, so you just keep repeated operation in X and Y. But it's basically the same operation done a few times. So this is how the whole code is written. So they're just three or four of this function, and your code is done. That's, for example, last example I want to do, otherwise it becomes too technical to solve. It's about how to program, for example, Upwind. Upwind is a very classical scheme that it is in most of convection code and many others, also in engineering. And in this way, you have the advection also. Just the total derivative is equal to the partial derivative time plus the advection. So the upwind, the idea of the upwind is that you rewrite this, this advection term just because if you have a cell, for example, like this, then if the flow is going to the right, well, you want to have the derivative from the left because it's going there and vice versa. So you want to transport the right derivative. That's called the upwind scheme. And so this is very easy to program. That's another trick that you use to parallelize, which is to use flag arrays. They're very simple to arrange. These are flag arrays. Basically, when you select elements inside your array, you can select elements with an intermediate array, which tells us which elements that you are selecting. So really, these are two or three techniques that you can learn in a matter of one day or two, just in with one Python notebook, just studying it and learning it. And that's all you need. That you can basically vectorize every code we really use in our field. Okay, I want to start with an example. This also to do strain rate with operation. Yeah. I see the students are always afraid of operators. That is my students. So, they're terrified. They call me Simpson. No? Give me the number from 9/11. Okay. These are other examples of operators. These are taken from the book. And so the book arrived basically here to the point in which you can do really nonlinear, heterogeneous rheology here, for example. These are very stiff particles with several orders of magnitude more viscous than the rest. That are vector, deform, and flow. These are like crystal in magma, okay? In magma, these simulations are very useful. And these are very stiff particles, and when they get vector, they form a unique flow, because stiff particles, basically their Green function is such that they interact at great distance, so they form a large unique flow. In this time, they are like bubbles. And of course, the viscosity is very low. What they do, they will create many small plumes, they will create many sets, because they will deform internally, and so the interaction between particles will be smaller, so they will interact only with the small neighbors. You can really test these things very easily. Write the code, it's really two pages of code, and do a lot of tests, a lot of interesting research. Okay, so let's talk about, so all the codes that I spoke about now are all in the book. And they're all sort of standard in geodynamics, so there is nothing really new. It's more and more the pedagogical part, so I didn't speak about new science. No, how much time I have? Okay, I want to just show two examples on this TED. The other reason why it is useful to use Jupyter Notebook and Python is that they give a really nice environment for developed science. Okay? And so I show two examples. First, one very computational, and the other very applied to just science, to volcanology. Or what you can do with this Jupyter notebook. So this is a development of a code that I'm doing just now. We just submitted our papers now with Peter Bura, his colleague from Australia, and which we use the lattice Boltzmann method, which is, I don't want to describe it, it can be complicated, but basically the lattice Boltzmann method, what you do, you have a fixed lattice, so there are no particles, no Lagrangian, nothing, and you have function here at every comma that describe the population of particles. So it's really called the kinetic theory. You solve the Boltzmann equation, so basically an approximation of the Boltzmann equation, close to equilibrium. And you do this all these corners. And you can solve, you can prove mathematically that, for example, the Navier-Stokes equation is an end member of this lattice Boltzmann method, but there are also many other cases. For example, fluids with larger molecular mean free path, like for example in the very upper atmosphere, can be modeled in this way. Also, the Navier-Stokes equation does not solve this kind of flow. And what is very important for us in geodynamics, if you want, is to is that they can deal very well with the sharp boundaries. For example, this is an example of how you can model wave propagation with this code. For example, if you have a pulse media where waves just cannot propagate inside these holes, and so can propagate only outside, you can model very easily the wave propagation from any source using this code. It's very simple to program. Or you can write, for example, the flow through a porous matrix. Here the blue part is when the flow can go, and the red part is where the flow is inhibited because it's solid. And you can easily follow the path, so this from one side to the other. Sorry, I think it's this side to this side. And you can, this is the speed at which the flow can go. So this is a very simple approach called lattice Boltzmann. And what I want to emphasize, just for the implementation part, is that because it is so simple to write, you can also very easily parallelize. This is parallelized on over 1,000 processors, just using MPI. And it's very straightforward to write it. So really, that's a kind of example of a little function that just sends the message from one processor to the other. It's really a few lines of code. Okay, and so now the last application was related to science. This is more work that I'm doing with the students, Brian and I. And what we study a volcano in Antarctica. And so my university very specialized in petroleum geology, so a lot of students go to do petroleum geology, but he came to me about in December and told me, okay, I changed my mind, don't want to do petroleum geology anymore. And I want to do volcanology, and I only 6 months to finish my thesis. And I want to do machine learning, and I want to do something new. Okay, not easy. So, but it's okay. I like the vision. So that's the kind of situation which you want to use an easy tool, a nice environment where a student really likes to work hard night and day on a project. And so we set up this little project. So it was very good because he could find a very interesting new data set. So this is basically the volcano called Erebus. And here at the rim of this volcano, there is a camera that has been installed by some scientists at Lamont. And they installed this in 2013. And this camera takes a picture of the lava lake that is inside the volcano. I didn't say this volcano is a Stromboli volcano. It erupts quite often, so on average once a day. Or sometimes for a couple of days it's not erupted, sometimes it erupts times in a day, but it erupts pretty often. So they took with this camera, they took images of the interior of the volcano every 2 seconds. Okay? And so of course they want to monitor the activity of the volcano. So they wrote some papers in which they look at the convection of the magma lake. There's a magma lake here, because this erupts often, so the magma is always outside. And they could do, and they can look at very simple image processes, like just look at luminosity in time, if, for example, to reconstruct the advection of the magma lake. This is an infrared camera, okay? So it's more luminous when it is hotter and when it is dark, when it's colder. But then what they couldn't do very well, because it's not easy, is to study the eruption itself, because all eruptions look different. So, for example, that's how an eruption looks like in this infrared camera. So this is the magma lake. This is the magma lake when nothing happens. So there is, maybe a ridge here in the middle, but, basically it stays there for a long time. And then a slug comes from below, and then you have an explosion. Okay? And so when you have an explosion, the magma is coming out and is going at the rim of the volcano. And so that's of course what you see. You see this hot signal because it's an infrared camera, but then it remains there for a long time, for at least half an hour, it remains hot, and then slowly it cools down. So the point is, how can you identify these phenomena automatically? So you imagine these are every image every 2 seconds for years. Okay, we calculated we have about 7-8 million images. Okay. So what they did, the student, had to spend a lot of time to study 1 month. That was December 2013. And look at all the images manually and find the eruptions, the small, the large, and it's a hard work of the graduate student. But you don't want to do that for years, okay? You want to find a better way to do that. So the idea is that, okay, let's use machine learning to do that, but we need to train the system. It's not easy. So fortunately, there is a seismometer that's been placed near the volcano. Before then, the camera that's placed here, this is the seismometer, this is the camera. And so we had some seismic images, seismic data here. And but I'm not a seismologist, but I like Beth said once, now you're an object analysis because you have aspect. So now we are all seismologists because we have OPSPY. That is a nice library in Python. Even a person like me who never did seismology, current seismology. So what we did, we studied this amount of data, and we found the typical inputs, the waveform, of corresponding to each eruption. So this is how they look like normally. One eruption, this is the Z, this is the horizontal signal. And so what we could do, we could stack all this eruption for 1 month. We knew in 1 month there were, I think, 31 eruptions for the was December 2001 and 2013. And so we could take the typical waveform, and what we could do, we could make the cross-correlation. So in cross-correlation, just you integrate all the signal in time with against this one, which was one of the three stacked images of the waveform. So basically, this is how it looks like a normal eruption from the seismic point of view. So when you do this for the entire month of December, that's what you see when you do the cross-correlation. So each one of these peaks is an eruption. Basically, is a moment in which the cross-correlation gives a big signal to that. Actually, no, this is what it looks like. Sorry. This is the signal that you see. This is the cross-correlation. Okay. That's the 1 week. That's the three component. This is one component. One component is a bit noisy. You get these small things. But with three component cross-correlation, so which, you sum all the cross-correlation for the three components, you get a very clear signal. So you can see when the eruptions really happen. And so by using this information, we could teach to a machine learning tool to learn that. So which one did you use? We use TensorFlow. TensorFlow is a machine learning tool developed by Google. And it is really the one that you use, for example, when you go on Google Images and you can, find the dog in my pictures, and then you can find the dog. I don't know if you ever tried. It's really amazing. You can find anything, find the place, find the glass, and it looks all my images and it finds one. Because it is trained to detect all the objects that we have normally in our life. It is really a very, the last one that we use, it's really a sophisticated laser. It's really made of neural networks, made of 48 layers, it's giant. It's called Inception 3, I think, if I'm not wrong. And what you can do, it's very simple, you take this giant network that's been already pre-trained to recognize all the objects that we are around us. You take away the last layer, which is the one that tells you which object it is, and you can retrain to learn something else. And so what we did, we were very ambitious at the beginning. So we were thinking, okay, we want to detect when there is an eruption, and after an eruption, we want to also try to detect before the eruption. So when the eruption is going to happen. And so we call also the pre-eruption. So we wanted the machine learning to look at every images and to see if there is no eruption at all, if there is an eruption at this moment, if there has been eruption in the last half an hour, or there will be an eruption. And so the way in which you train this net is pretty simple. You bet there is something that is called back propagation. Basically, you give it an image, it tells you what it is, it's in the beginning is wrong, you tell, okay, this all made, basically all these OTCs are just a multiplication of many, many matrices. That's what all this machine learning tool is. So there are many matrices they learn, and then you retrain all these matrices in order to teach him what you want it to do. And so you do it a lot of times. This is about 400,000 times that what we needed to teach it to reach a precision of about 90%. This is the training set. This is the check set that we use to the benchmark set. And so you can teach it to recognize these four groups, and then you check how it works. So what we found is that pre-eruption didn't really work. So you can already train it to... So, I mean, there is no precursor, in other words, in the images of the eruption, at least not from the point of view of the machine learning. But we saw that it works really well in terms of detecting eruptions. So what you see here is 1 hour of data when they see an eruption in between, okay? So, and each one of these points, I don't know if it is visible, is the probability that the machine gives that there is no eruption. And it's looking only at one image, it's not looking at the time series, or that there is an eruption, that there is a post-eruption. And so what the machine is saying, basically, when there is no eruption, it gives almost 100% of probability obviously that there is no eruption, so we can see that. And when there is an eruption, so basically there is an event like the one that we saw before, immediately detects it. And then very interesting, it also can detect post-eruption. So if you think post-eruption is quite similar to an eruption, because you just have this magma at the side of the rim of the volcano that is very, you know, that is very hot. But it still can learn it. It just makes some mistakes at the very beginning, because sometimes it gives some false alarms, but basically just for the first few meters, and then it detects it perfectly. So we could detect every event like the others, after the other. But that's a summary of the whole result. So this is the cross-correlation that we got from the seismic data. And this is the result from the machine learning tool. So when you see a line, let me remember. So when you see, it's a really bad resolution, but anyway, I think the blue lines is the detection of the eruption, and the red that follows is the post-eruption. And this is 1 week of data. So this is really a lot of time, okay? So each one of these is a detection of an eruption. You see that it really works well. And particularly here, I went to see to each one of these ones. So when there is a detection of an eruption followed by a post-eruption, you see that the most of the time is correct. And sometimes there is a false detection, but I'll show you in a second that the percentage is not so often. And the very interesting, so I'm sorry, again, the resolution is so low, so nice on my screen. And when there is a false detection like this one, sometimes instead it was just a very small eruption. So in other words, we trained the network to learn, like, to recognize big eruptions. It could also recognize more ones. Okay. So here you see better. So this was instead a very small eruption. So that's just the summary. And this is for example. So what we did to compensate for this error here, that you get sometimes a detection again after the very first detection, we say if you detect an eruption in a moment, for the next 5 minutes, you detect it again when it's still the same as before. So by doing so, we could reduce the false detection to a very low number, like less than 30%. So of the eruption, over 70% were correct. So when I put plus, it means it is correct. And when I put minus, it means the direction, the detection was incorrect. So you can see with the statistics that we obtained, and the minus are the negative one. Many of them were just smoke, of course, because you know when there was an eruption, it got a lot of smoke coming out of the crater, and so there was the incorrect detection. Okay, so let's conclude. This is just the next step of which we are working on. So to use machine learning on the spectrogram and on the seismic data. But you can ask me later if you want more details. Okay, so that's just the conclusion. So Jupyter can be really a revolution in applied computer science in pedagogy, I think. And I want to emphasize just that Python is really a useful tool. Now, there are so many tools in Python. Parallel computing is very fast. And there are also PyPets, I didn't speak about all the libraries that exist. I mean, you can look at them online. And also to look, it's important to look at machine learning. Almost all tools that exist, there is also PyTorch, there are many other tools, they're all written in Python. There are just no tools in machine learning that are not written in Python. And just I wanted to say that, you know, graduate students found this environment, I think, much easier to work on than what they use portfolio, which was just to program everything in C. And I like to, you know, learn very quickly, have fun. And, you know, my student finished, graduated, you know, because with success in June, after 6 months, working night and day. But he really did a great job. Thank you.
Any quick questions?
The wave propagation in the porous media that you showed us with the Boltzmann, I guess, formulation, is that a 2D example, or is that a 3D?
That was 2D, but now we just finished with the 3D. Just a
little, and is it slower than, like, SpecFAM that does the poroelastic?
I guess we didn't check this, okay. But it would be nice to see that, yeah. But we didn't benchmark that. I don't know what the SpecFAM is.
There's a poroelastic.
Right, it would be interesting to put it. We will check that. We just finished providing 3D code, so I don't know.
Cool.
So how practical do you think it would be to actually publish papers in Jupyter Notebook? I mean, I know for my own code, I'm not necessarily a great coder, but like, never 50 lines of code. It's much, much more than that. So it seems like it would just be very confusing if you actually published a paper in Jupyter Notebook.
Well, it's completely depends on what is the code. I mean, you write a new code that is very long for every paper. Mostly you'd use a library that exists. I mean, at least what we did, working with the seismic data, that's what we're going to do. I mean, all these two works, both the work on lattice Boltzmann method and this one in volcanology, we're going to publish it as a, we're going to publish as a standard paper because now that's a standard. And then we're going to put as extra material Jupyter Notebook so that everybody can just reproduce the results. Now, your specific application may require a very long code, I don't know. But we found that many often, I'm doing another work with another student in which we look at the seismic data, and we have, let's see if I have it open. Yeah, this one. And so that's pretty big. Okay, so that's one Jupyter node that we're going to publish together with the paper. And so it is long. So it is really long, several. You can see here, that's a very giant notebook. But we're going to publish all of it. Because really, the message is that people should be able to reproduce our result. So here there are maybe good 1,000, 2,000 lines of code. But that's okay. I mean, it's...
Sure, but in this case as well, like, if you can just include the code. Like, would someone reading the paper, yeah, that this was the paper, I'd almost think it'd be more confusing to read the paper this way if you have many thousands of lines of code.
Yeah. It depends on what is the use that you want to do the paper. If you just read it to understand what people have done, I agree, you can just take a PDF. But if you want to work it out and check, for example, change some parameters. So let's assume, yeah, we did some, we used to study Coulomb stress. So, yeah. And you may really, people have different opinion about the elastic parameters inside the fault. So we made some assumptions. So people want to go there, okay, but what would happen if they would have taken another Lamé parameters there? You can do it in a second. You change it here in the node by the node, you click one button, and in 2 minutes you have the results. So I think this is really powerful. I agree, but if you just want to know what people have done quickly, then yes, you just want to read the PDF and the quick summary.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.